The Guardian.
Away! Away! Yes! Come on! Italy!
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. And that yell was me at the final whistle at Wembley. England 2, Germany 0. England don't beat Germany in the knockout stages of tournaments. They just don't do it. But today they did. No huge drama, but they did enough. Raheem Sterling scoring again and Harry Kane's header sending almost all the 42,000 odd crowd absolutely wild. What was this? A measured defensive masterclass or a game that was about taking your chances? How many of us will wake up in the middle of the night and see Thomas Müller bearing down slowly on Jordan Pickford? We have English reaction, reaction from Germany, Nordic reaction and Barry reaction. So now a quarterfinal in Rome against Ukraine on Saturday night after they beat Sweden in extra time. Also, you've sent us some emails and questions and the like, so we'll do all of that. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Mark Langdon from the Racing Post. Good evening.
Good evening, Max.
Hello, Lars Sivertsen.
Hi, Max.
In Cologne, Archie Rintutt.
Hello.
And Barry Glendenning. Welcome. Lainey says, how long before Barry's first loud sigh?
I don't know, Max. It's been a long, long day. It's very late, and I'd quite like to get into the bed that's right behind me and curl up and go to sleep.
It's all right. In about after half an hour of talking about England's victory, you can pretty much do that. England's 300th international match at Wembley. About 42,000 there. England have kept a clean sheet in each of their opening four matches at a major tournament for the second time. The other being, do you know what year, Barry?
Oh, I can't remember. I heard Gary Lineker say it earlier and I've forgotten. A long time ago.
Anyone else want to guess?
Italia 90.
1966, everybody. Of course it was.
Oh, no.
Simon says, is it... It can't be, can it? Is it, can it? Is it, can't be? Is it really? Is it possible? Will it? At the end of the game, I had a very quick chat with Barney Ronay, me at one end of the ground, him in the press box across a dodgy Zoom, and here it is.
Barney, hello from my bit of Wembley to your bit of Wembley. How did you find that?
Yeah, it was amazing. I'm right over by the England fans here, and people went completely mental. I'm a bit worried for them. There's people rolling down the seats. There's a feeling of people just barely able to believe what they can see. This is a weird alternative timeline where these things happen. In retrospect, every decision is vindicated. England was solid. They didn't give anything away. They surged just when they had to. And for 20 minutes to the end, they just went away with it. It was a really good performance, which started off looking like it might lose its way. And everything Gareth has done is vindicated. Nobody scored against them, and they march on.
I found the sort of the silence when Müller went through was just quite incredible, because there'd been so much noise, and just the absence of intake of breath collectively of everybody was such a huge moment in this game.
Yeah, it was really incredible that we missed that. You imagine how many times he's done that. It's the most basic training routine. And he put it a foot past the post, completely no pressure at all. I felt really sorry for him beating the turf in pain, and it would probably become a meme pretty quickly. But it was a kind of terrible moment for him. You know, I like him as a player and a guy. But it just it wasn't me. I mean, you know, they had their chances, and Germany did look good at times, but England are just solid and they know exactly what they're doing. And Sterling has been fantastic in this tournament. That's to be said. In a team that doesn't really attack, he's absolutely carried them. And he deserves a huge amount of credit for that.
Questions about Harry Kane. I mean, from where I was sitting or standing, he didn't move a whole lot, but that goal felt just so huge for him.
I thought he changed when Grealish came on. I don't know why. It may have just been a coincidence. But he suddenly seemed to move. He suddenly just think he was going to get a pass. I don't know what it was. Maybe he got a second win. But yeah, he was absolutely abysmal for an hour. And then he scored. And he actually looked looked like he knew what he wanted to do even before he scored. It was just strange. He seemed to really change in what he was doing. But, you know, we will see. They go to Rome now, and you kind of think, well, maybe anything is possible.
And what did you make of the atmosphere? I actually thought the fans were more patient than I'm used to England fans being.
The atmosphere was, I thought, really good. It was constant noise. People didn't lose it with England when they were a bit slow or when things were difficult. I think that people kind of grudgingly trusted in what was happening. And 45,000, this is the biggest crowd since the pandemic hit. People were just sort of blinking in the light. I think people could really believe what they were seeing.
Look, Barney, we'll let you go, but thanks for coming on. I appreciate it, as always. Right, from Wembley, this is Max signing back to Max in his spare room. Max.
Thanks, Max, for that incisive interview. Mark says, I could hear Barry saying, oh God, from here when that second went in. Jan says, can we just, for non-English listeners, have Barry say, oh God, for 10 consecutive minutes? they keep on coming, Barry. Jordan, if England win the Euros, will Barry sing Football's Coming Home?
No.
No.
No, I won't.
Sam, can Barry please sing Football's Coming Home? I'll send him some Canadian maple syrup if he does.
I don't want Canadian maple syrup.
Okay. Barca Jim, do Barry and I get a bothy with no TV reception or Wi-Fi in the Highlands or County Offaly on the 11th of July? Owen, does Barry want to come and live in my house in Ireland for a few weeks on the off?
Sorry, are you really just going to make this podcast all about me?
Well,
from what I've been reading, England have just recorded the greatest triumph in their history, the World Cup final in 1966 included. Yeah. It's just one chin-stroking think piece after another being churned out by one journalist after another, many of whom I respected up until about 2 hours ago, discussing how this is the greatest English performance in the modern era and that Southgate has proved all his detractors wrong. Yeah, it was quite a good win.
Mark, thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with Barry. I think it's not the greatest result ever. I think that we shouldn't overrate this German team, really. I think because of what Germany had done to England in the past, there was that fear factor. But you know, when you actually saw them on the pitch, they weren't that good. They weren't as good as some of the other German teams. It was still I think another solid performance from England. The nation's right to be excited, particularly with the way the draw has opened up. But you know, one game at a time, Max. One game at a time.
And just to say, in Mark's 2 minutes answer there, Barry necked half a glass of red wine and lit a fag. Lars.
Yeah.
A dispassionate view on that performance.
I mean, I disagree with Barry a bit here. I thought this was quite a stunning vindication for Gareth Southgate, because you have to, the context here, yes, Germany are a bit of a rabble, fine, I'll go along with that. But England have, over the years, had a huge problem with national team managers who have just been too weak to drop some of the big names when that needed to be done, who have tried to shoehorn in as many famous and exciting names as possible into the team, even if it made no sense tactically. Here you have Southgate, who's actually been brave enough and strong enough to say, actually, the system needs to come before the personnel. And yes, he has all these exciting attacking players that we all want to see on the pitch, but that doesn't necessarily make it smart to squeeze many of them into the team. And with Germany, the only real threat they've shown in the tournament was against Portugal, when they found space out wide and they worked it from side to side. So Southgate went, okay, well, we'll match your wing backs so that structurally doesn't happen. And it worked. Germany offered very, very little. Pickford had to make a good save off of Werner. You have the Müller miss, sure. But by and large, his approach nullified the threat that Germany did have, and in the end, England were able to create enough to win. And I think that is a huge vindication for him. If you look back to people going wild on social media when the team came up, it's too negative, it's too negative. It's like, you know, it was a smart way of setting up the team for that game. The fact that Germany did, the two big chances they did create was when they got in behind. It does kind of show you that as much of a mess as they were, they still have absolutely brilliant central midfielders, and they have quick and smart guys up front. So if England had actually opened up and attacked more and been less conservative, they could have been picked apart like they have been before. It was a complete vindication of Southgate's fairly unpopular approach to the tournament and the team.
I was just going to say, I am aware that anything I say here is just going to be interpreted as some sort of sour grapery, and probably to an extent it is. But Lars says that Germany created very little. They created an identical amount of chances to England, but just failed to score any of them. And people are... I think it's unfair on England to say that, you know, this is a very bad German team, because obviously you can only beat what is in front of you. But if this German team are as bad as people are saying, they still created three good scoring chances to the three England created. England happened to score two of theirs, and that's why they've gone through. And this is knockout football. Winning is everything. And it was a good win, and Southgate's team selection, which I thought was too negative, has been vindicated. But in the much the same way that I suspect England won't fear Ukraine, I don't think Ukraine will have seen anything tonight that will have them trembling in their boots either.
Archie, thoughts?
I have to agree with Barry about the standard of this England team. As much as I enjoyed that win as an Englishman in Germany, and know that I've avoided a good few years of continual ribbing at the hands of fellow German journalists who are always going, England, no? And you're just like, okay, good, I don't have to take that anymore. It's just quite a relief. At the same time, I sat there and thought, can this England side do more? How good is this performance? And I mean, there's a German word for everything, and I think the Spielglück, like the match luck, was on England's side. For once, you cannot explain that moment when Thomas Müller goes through on goal in any other fashion. Thomas Müller has never scored in a European Championships, and you're thinking, as he's bearing down on goal, even to the moment that he hits the ball and I see it from the TV angle, I'm like, so this is nestling in the corner. And the fact that it didn't, there's some narrative which circles back on itself from 2010, when under Joachim Löw, Thomas Müller, I think, spearheaded that 4-1 against England, and this generation, this new smart generation of Germany players coming through. And just to see Joachim Löw's reign end today with somebody that he had to call back, remember, who he dropped and was putting out of the national team for good under him just a couple of years ago. He called him back after much pressure here in Germany. And for then, Thomas Müller, who I think, if you'd picked, gone through that Germany side and been like, who do you want to go through one-on-one at 1-0 down, and you've got to take this chance at Wembley, I think he would have been one of the first people you might have picked. So that moment feels, yeah, it's the sliding doors one in this one. But it's nice for once that it comes out on England's side.
Do you know, Lee says, I can't wait for this podcast. Question, how much time was there to get housework done, domestic chores, while Müller was running through on goal? It felt like it was about an hour. The interesting thing is, I don't disagree massively with you, Barry. There was a point in that second half where basically I was watching England sort of pat the ball about a bit, and it would get in behind, and then one of Mats Hummels would sort of turn and just lump it upfield, and it would be headed back. And I thought, this feels a bit like I'm watching a League One playoff final. Just at moments, I just thought the quality was not sensationally high in that game. That doesn't mean that England didn't have good performances over the pitch, but I didn't think it was. I tend to agree. I think the result is everything, but it didn't blow me away. The fact that they got through it is a statement in itself, because England don't normally. Mark, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I think that definitely there was that sort of period in the second half, the sort of first bit of it, where it just felt like there was a stalemate. And I've been critical of Southgate's inability to change matches and make the right substitutions and be positive. And he actually did make a substitution that turned the game England's way. And I think if you go back to particularly, say, that Croatia World Cup semi-final, where you could see from a long way out that something needed changing, and he just didn't quite know what needed to be done. And, you know, eventually Croatia just grabbed the initiative in that game. But bringing on Grealish for Saka, and it would have been a difficult one because Saka had been very lively in the first half, did really help England, because obviously Grealish was involved in both of the goals. But I also think that his link up with Luke Shaw helped the team a lot, and that when Sterling and Shaw were down that side together, it wasn't really happening at all. And, you know, Sterling came into the game probably more from the right, and, you know, Shaw also, I think, became more positive when Grealish was there. Maybe there was a bit more space to attack because, you know, Grealish was coming inside. And that substitution, I think, is where I would give Southgate a lot of credit for. Maybe not necessarily, you know, how it all started, but, you know, how it finished and what he did during the game.
Lars, what did you make of Sterling's performance? You know, yet another goal, 15 goals in his last 20 England games, and yet people are still sort of furious when he's selected.
Well, people just don't like him, and I guess with a lot of them, you're not going to change that anytime soon, because, I mean, if you've seen him play in this tournament and in this team and you don't see the importance he has to how it works, then that's just something you've made up your mind about, and it's not based on any sort of rational view of what's happening on the pitch. He scored the goal, yeah, but he was also very important in terms of his movement and the runs he makes, and making space for others. I mean, it's clear. I understand the criticism, and I shared the criticism going into the tournament, because he just hadn't been great for Man City. I mean, that's also just a fact. That's fair enough, but I think he's more than shown why he's so important to this team in this tournament. And I guess the reasons for why certain people just don't like him are something, are a big subject that we should go into on another pod.
Lars, there are England players that we should praise.
Yeah,
lots today. You know, the back three were impressive. Shaw and Trippier played well. Phillips and Rice, you know, worked manfully. And I thought Rice, I mean, I was quite near him when we were 1-0 up, and he sort of went to the crowd, come on. And I was like, it's too early to be doing that, Declan. I just like, let's the Germans might notice we're winning. Don't do that sort of thing. But there were, you know, there were strong performances all over the pitch.
And I mean, Rice played 80 minutes on a yellow card here, which in his role is not necessarily easy. It might make him more hesitant to go into challenges and stuff like that. So, and actually, you know, both your central midfielders get carded. I had a small bet on each of them to get sent off here, because I thought we were heading for a very typical England catastrophe. But they managed to stay on the pitch, the both of them. That was very good. I thought Harry Maguire made a good point, actually, after the game, about how he said something like, we have good defenders in this country, but maybe because of the Premier League, every little mistake gets scrutinised. And I think that's a fair shout. I think we talk about how Jadon Sancho is maybe out of sight, out of mind a bit, because he's scoring and dominating in a league that not enough people in this country watch. But on the opposite end of the scale, we don't see foreign defenders in foreign league make mistakes week in and week out. Like, whereas every little thing you do wrong in the Premier League, you immediately become a meme. So I wonder if maybe we're harder on the defenders who play in England, and I say we as in everyone, than we are to the ones who play abroad, for instance. I mean, I've seen Hummels do some weird stuff for Dortmund, which I think I can only imagine what social media would be like if he did that kind of stuff in for an English team. So I think Harry Maguire was onto something, and he was very good in the game.
Insight in mind. Marcus says, congrats England from a German. That was embarrassing. Glad to see Sterling doing well. He's not been treated well by the English fans and press. What's the general view, Archie? Embarrassing, or it could have gone either way? What's the feeling?
Oh, how long you got?
about sort of 8 minutes.
Okay. So it's really difficult to measure an overall view because of how much contrast there is within, I'd say, your average German football fan. I think a lot of them are disillusioned with the national team. I know plenty of club fans who just don't really take an interest in it, but I think that they've become bloated on their own successes. But that said, there was still, going to the three games in Munich,
during this tournament, and seeing the amount of love for Joachim Löw was something I didn't expect, and I think shows you how much respect that he has amongst a large proportion of Germans who he continued that legacy of the 2006 World Cup, which made Germany feel good about themselves, which they've not been able to do for a very long time. And every few weeks in a year, Joachim Löw's side gave that to them. And they played some great football as well. And look, mistakes have been made. I think that things really started to come apart for Germany in 2018 with the whole Mesut Özil affair. That's when the real cracks and lines were drawn, because it seemed like they were a unit until then. But that's when it was actually, are we all on the same side? So look, Löw has made mistakes, undoubtedly. The criticism of him in the post-match interview from either Bastian Schweinsteiger or the ARD host here, Jesse Velmer, was not, I'd say, particularly sharp, but it more showed that there's more a feeling of gratitude towards Löw, and even from the players. Like, I think you would have expected a stronger revolt had Germany gone many, many years without winning a title. But he's just seen as such a people person within that squad. He is universally liked, it seems. Even Thomas Müller seemed to put away that few years of him being out of the national team. And I think it tells you something. He's very well liked by the people that he works with. And I don't think he really wanted to go, but undoubtedly, it's for the best. He probably should have gone earlier. Probably. He should have gone earlier, full stop.
Yeah. What do you think, Mark? What happens to this Germany team, do you think? It was interesting, the Portugal game, when they were so good, and I know that was because Portugal just didn't defend how you should defend against this Germany team. You thought, God, this team, they're bloody brilliant.
Yeah, but I think that's one of the problems when you've got a coach maybe that kind of is either past his best or the team are not quite in sync with him, because, you know, as soon as, England had worked out, as I think was mentioned earlier, the way to stop the Germans' attacks, he then didn't have, another way of trying to open up England other than that. You know, they kind of already shown what they could do against Portugal, and then it became pretty obvious the way to stop them. I think in terms of the future, obviously Hansi Flick is shown himself to be a good coach, and I think it would be suited to national team duties as well. I think he's somebody that's obviously been around that system before. Kai Havertz was one of the players that I think stood out for Germany today, the way that he sort of appreciation of space, and, you know, given what a mess maybe other parts of the team were, you know, for him to show up as an individual, I think bodes well for the future. So, Joshua Kimmich is, you know, they're only going to get better. So it's not like that, you know, they're completely, this is not, I don't think this is Euro 2000 style, completely terrible German team. I think that, that they'll be better in the future. And like I said, I thought Kai Havertz was definitely somebody that Germany and for Chelsea fans can really look forward to over the next few years.
On a slightly different note, Cam says, can we please discuss the booing of the Germany anthem? It was deafening. No other country does this.
Surprise me.
Yeah, certainly not as loud or as many people doing it. This is why people across Europe can't support England. It is true. That it's interesting. It was incessant, and it felt like they turned the music up in the stadium. It felt like the volume was increased for the music to sort of drown it out a bit. As opposed,
no one mentions it here, by the way.
Do they not?
Like, no, it's just kind of like, okay, England.
I don't know. I mean, I feel sort of embarrassed when that happens. I want everyone to stand up respectfully. I don't know if it's, some people view it as just tribalism. That was different to the booing of the knee, which I did hear, but that really felt in the stadium like that was drowned out by like a huge round of applause when it happened. I mean, it's...
Well, yeah, you had booing of the German national anthem and booing of the knee and lots of middle-aged men with no shirts on that look like thumbs in the stands. But, you know... There's not a huge amount you can do about that. You would like to say it's a minority, but you know, the booing of the German national anthem, which is disgraceful, booing anyone's anthem is, that was bloody loud. The one thing I would say, Max, is I think it shouldn't be overlooked. Today, you know, everyone's had a lousy year and a half. This seemed like a landmark day, just with a massive crowd at Wembley, generally good vibes. An England win and they get a big monkey off their backs. And, yeah, that, I think that is all to be applauded. But there's always going to be a few twats who try to ruin it.
Sure. Lars?
I think there's almost a danger of over-focusing on it. Not that we shouldn't bring it up, but the booing of the knee and the booing of the anthem and stuff. Because, like the tweet says, that's why no one likes England. But I think it's worth repeating that, like, not all England fans behave like that. You know, for every person who looks like a thumb and boos everything, you know, that there are people like yourself, Max, who do not do those things, and people who sort of have basic manners and common decency, who also care about England. And I don't think necessarily the thugs and the idiots should be allowed to sort of copyright liking England. That doesn't seem right to me, and we shouldn't allow that to happen.
It's also worth pointing out that this English team is a very likeable bunch of young men with a very, very likeable manager, which, you know, makes it difficult to wish ill on them, but I will continue to do so.
Dan says, was Muller Rice the best yoghurt themed midfield battle we've ever seen? Thank you, Dan. Jay says, how much extra butter will Mark slather on his toast to celebrate?
It's late enough, isn't it, Max? I've not had any butter for at least a week. I'm not somebody that tucks in celebration. You know, it's more when I'm feeling a bit down. I think that I tuck in.
I'm amazed you haven't had. I presumed you were butter every day. You're a binge butter eater.
Yeah, I am. Yeah,
you live for the weekend.
It's more in the moods. I've not really had a chance to eat that much during the Euros, to be honest, Max. It's been so hectic that one of those things.
Should always find time to eat, Mark. All right. Well, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll look back at Ukraine sneaking past Sweden in the last minute of extra time. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We are still in the top 20 for the Listener Choice Award at the British Podcast Awards. You can vote for us because coming 17th, you know, we don't want to be Crystal Palace in this, right? You know, we won't mention it again. Even if Patrick Vieira takes over the podcast, we would like to win this title. And with The Guardian, we're not supported by an oligarch or a rogue state anywhere. You know, we're the good guys. BritishPodcastAwards.com/vote. If you'd like to vote for us, just go to that link, type in Guardian Football Weekly and vote for us. So then, Ukraine beat Sweden 2-1 in extra time. Lars, tell me all about it, please.
It was the best game of the day, obviously, though. I guess it kind of, I mean, for entertainment value, maybe it was. I think Ukraine were kind of back to being quite a little bit more fun again after having that sort of weird game against Austria in which they did nothing at all. I thought the Yarmolenko cross for the first goal was right up there amongst my sort of favourite little moments of the tournament. I mean, unbelievable. What a guy Yarmolenko is in terms of just sort of turning up for these tournaments. It's great. I love players who are just mysteriously a lot better for their national teams than we see them regularly. I obviously feel sorry for Sweden. I feel sorry for Emil Forsberg, who had a tremendous game and really should have had three goals. I mean, the woodwork was not kind to Forsberg here. And it has really been one of the better playing players of the tournament, I would argue. But then everyone just kind of ran out of steam, and you get the red card, which I'm sure we'll have to talk about. And in the end, yeah, I guess that's the way it goes.
Matt did email on that red card question. Was Max more satisfied with England ending 55 years of knockout torment at the hands of Germany, or his Danielsson gag finally coming full circle with the Sweden defender's red card? Do you know what? I felt so sorry for Danielsson, whether I should or not, that I didn't do a Karate Kid gag on Twitter, because I just feel, and I'm happy to be outvoted by all of you, I feel like there is a problem in the laws of the game with the follow through that VAR has arisen since VAR, in the sense that he played the ball completely, and I understand letter of the law, that is a red card because intent doesn't matter, but I think it needs looking at. I think sometimes people get injured because their leg is in the wrong place. Yeah. And if anything, the Ukrainian attacked his studs with the side of his knee. Which is obviously not a sensible thing to do, but I don't think that should be a red. I don't think that should be a red card. I'm happy to be shouted down by anyone, Barry.
I'm glad you're not my lawyer, Matt.
Yeah. Barry, what do you think?
I initially thought it was a red, and I've completely revised my opinion. By the letter of the law, yes, it is a red, but the law, like you say, needs looking at. I'm not sure what he could possibly have done to avoid that situation occurring.
Does anyone disagree with that? Because, you know...
Well, I'm kind of with Barry on this in the sense that, yeah, if you look at the way the law is written now, where it says just very, very simply, a tackle or challenge that endangers the safety of an opponent must be sanctioned as serious foul play, and then a red. And then you look at the replay, or even you look at it first time if you look at it properly. I don't necessarily agree that this is a VAR problem. I think it's always been an issue. If it's that black and white, then yeah, it's a red card. But I think there is something here about how there are certain actions on a football field that you have to be, that you should reasonably be expected to be allowed to do. I mean, you have to be able to kick a ball. And I don't think we should outlaw any sort of raising of the foot involved. It becomes farcical. And what also adds to the situation here is that it's to a large extent the Ukrainian player who makes the action dangerous by running into the thing. So it is tricky, I agree.
I think that Danielson here was also killed by the brilliant HD slow-mo angle of the challenge, because it's just so... Like, if you're trying to prove a red card, then that is the angle for it. When you freeze it at the moment of impact, it looks horrible. And I think if you add that to everything that is said about, you know, dangerous challenges and that, and you can understand why from a refereeing point of view, when they're encouraged to try and remove danger from the game, you can understand that point of view as well. But that's the one thing, is just the height of the leg and the control as well. It's like, I think that having control over your challenges is something that needs to be taken into account as well. Of course, we want to see, you know, a certain amount of power within the game, or at least I do. I think everyone enjoys a good sliding tackle, but there's just also a limit where, like, it's crossing that line of how do we protect players, and how do we also maintain that physical element of the sport that we love. But yeah,
this wasn't even a tackle; it was a clearance. Like, you know, it was a high clearance. I think he was in total control. It was just something happened to be in his way as he was landing. Mark, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I agree that he was unlucky, but I don't know how you would rewrite that law to make it sort of so that wouldn't be a red card, because if you do, and I think you would just end up with defenders leaving one on attackers more often than not. I think that it just falls into that unlucky category, really, of the referee didn't have any option. But I don't see how you could rewrite that law. I don't know if anybody else would have a way of doing it.
And the way it was explained to me by a referee once, which I think is the sort of phrase I find very helpful in these situations, is that you are responsible for where your limbs end up on the field on a football field. And in this case, you know, again, you ended up with studs up and a straight leg straight in someone's knee. And if you end up like that, then you've gone wrong somewhere. But I completely accept that there are certain actions they should reasonably be able to expect to be able to perform, like kicking a ball, and that it is a challenge. But I also think, like, when we have these, you see the ex-pros go completely wild on social media, because I think a lot of ex-footballers seem to think that if you don't intend for something bad to happen, you should never be punished if something bad does happen. It's a very strange version of the of life, according to ex-professional. Like, Lineker comparing it to the guy who shoots and then collides into someone. He's gone completely round the bend. But I do accept that there is a grey zone at work here, and it's tricky.
Aidan says, and this is an interesting subject to, in terms of just covering football. At the time of writing, half-time and extra time, Sweden only have four of their starting 11 left on the pitch. Surely this must be a record without a match being abandoned. I don't know about you, Barry, but like this has happened like in the last, like yesterday, in that sort of breathless day of football. It's very hard to keep up with who's there and what the shape is and who's doing what. Just as a viewer or a listener, or certainly somebody trying to take notes and think about something intelligent to say about the game.
Yeah, well, I find when I'm doing the minute-by-minute reports that keeping track of the subs is quite A, time-consuming, and B, a lot of faff. But you kind of have to report each one in case someone comes on and then does something instrumental in the game and people are going to go, well, he wasn't playing. I think perhaps... Well, you're allowed, is it six substitutes if the game goes to extra time? I think that's too many. I think four is more than ample, not just because it would make my life easier. But I think what was interesting, I think Emil Kraft went off after Danielsson had been sent off. Emil Kraft sustained a head injury and went off. Sweden had used all their substitutes and he came back on again. I'm not sure he should have, but if he hadn't, Sweden would have been down to nine men. There will, of course, be Newcastle fans who would argue they would be better off with nine men than 10 men, including Emil Kraft. But that's another story for another day. But I think six... I'm saying six is a bit excessive, but then towards the end of extra time in that game, the players were absolutely dead on their feet, shattered. It was like a battle scene from Game of Thrones there. So I don't really know.
Archie?
It just felt really weird to watch this game be taking place on the same island that England, Germany had been taking place on, with the complete lack of atmosphere that was there. And that is one element that, I mean, I think it will be thrown at England and people will not care, but if England are not to go far in this tournament, then you do wonder when, because everything has been geared so much in their favour with the amount of games that they've got to play at Wembley and that kind of advantage. And yeah, I think that even though it was a good game, I think if this had come before England-Germany, we would have said, oh, well, this is the France, Switzerland, Croatia, Spain spirit continuing, but because of it coming after England, Germany, it just felt weird, I think, just particularly from an English perspective, to be watching it. When actually it's an amazing story that Ukraine have got this far, and like with the Ukrainian charisma that is Andrei Yarmolenko, who knows what they could do against England.
I mean, I would say, first of all, the England-Germany game was supposed to be in Dublin, but had to be moved. And there are two stadiums in this tournament that should not be being used. One is that awful place in Seville, and the other is Hampden Park, which is a diabolical stadium for football. And even Scotland's players want their games moved to either Celtic Park or Ibrox because they hate playing at Hampden so much. But because the Scottish FA own it, that's where they're stuck.
Andrew says, one for you, Max. Sounded like Jonathan Pierce said that Sweden's equaliser came off Matt Bianco. Nice that the 80s band are involved in this year's Euros after many years without a hit. Producer Ian heard this. I heard this. A couple of people, sort of what I've become is that's what people come to me. People don't come to me and say, was that a red card? They just say, is Matt Bianco, playing for Ukraine? Who was that? Who did he mean to say, Lars?
Matvienko, I guess. The defender.
Oh, yes, that sounds quite accurate. It was a bit like I don't think I mentioned it yesterday, but for a second I thought Spain's fifth goal had been scored by Jose Maria Olazabal, and I thought that was quite that was quite the move. Fair play to him. What a talent he is. Right, that'll do for part two. Part three, a bit of rowing French people and any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Barry, French media have been reporting on a fallout from the France's departure from the Euros.
Yeah, it turns out that there was a lot of acrimony in the stands, particularly that section of the stand where the players' families were sat. And I know Philippe holds Adrien Rabiot in the lowest of regard. And it was Rabiot's mother, Veronique, who's his, also his agent, who was at the centre of this kerfuffle. She does have a lot of previous for being very difficult to deal with. And she clashed with members of Paul Pogba's family after he gave away the ball in the build-up to Switzerland's third goal and was, you know, giving them all sorts of grief. Why is your son giving the ball away? Blah, blah, blah. And then at full time, she had a go at Kylian Mbappe's father and mother, telling them that they should instruct their son to be far less arrogant. I've always thought that French dressing room is perhaps not particularly harmonious, and I suspect it may become less harmonious in the near future. But I like to think that while all that was going on, N'Golo Kante's mum and dad were, you know, sitting quietly, eating their sandwiches and drinking from their flask of tea and just being nice, smiling politely at everyone.
This brings back memories of a trip to the Bernabeu when Spurs played the first time, the Champions League quarterfinal game against Real Madrid. And I was with the Spurs sort of players' families were in a very close proximity. And Aurelio Gomez hadn't had one of his best nights, I seem to remember. And he was getting quite a lot of stick from the travelling Spurs supporters towards the end of the game. And then this little boy just turned around and said, "That's my dad." And oh, to which like, everybody just fell silent and sort of, good goalkeeper. We like him. Good goalkeeper. It was a very strange and uncomfortable situation for a moment.
Simon says, the new Beko fridge advert shows some Barcelona player go round a child's house to get him to eat carrots. What player / team would have to go to Mark Langling's house to get him to eat carrots?
That's a well. If England win the Euros, maybe if Harry Kane brings the trophy and some carrots, we can have a little nibble on them together.
Right. So what he's got to do is fill the trophy with hummus. Harry Kane comes to your house with a trophy full of hummus and a carrot baton, and then you will then eat a carrot.
I think Harry Kane's a good lad. He's done lots in the community before. Let's get it on.
Would you dress up as a rabbit as well?
If they win the Euros and Harry Kane comes around my house, then yes, Archie.
Michelle says, "Hi, Max and team. I'm a listener from Switzerland. I can assure you that Barry's praise of the Swiss team was, if anything, too much for a Swiss. However, I could have listened to Philippe slagging off the French and Didier forever. That's how we are, and I cannot wait for the Germans to go crashing out," says Michelle. "One more thing, now that I'm writing to you. I have been listening to the pod for many years, but it was not until very recently Googling an article that I discovered that I needed to search for Philippe Eau Claire rather than Filippo Claire." Enjoy the rest of the Euros. Thank you very much. Graham says, "I'd like to register my disappointment regarding yesterday's pod concerning the lame attempts to create a pun around the surname of the promising young Spanish player Pedri. Please could we just agree that Pedri is a cultured player and leave it at that." Thank you, Graham. Much appreciated. And Jason and Lee, two separate ones, not Jason Lee, I hasten to point out, both emailed to say, "Has Barry remembered to bring his bins in this evening after quite a lot of yesterday's pod was you describing taking your bins out?"
Yeah, I brought them in this afternoon.
Thank you, Barry. And that'll do for today's podcast. Thank you, Lars Sivertsen.
Anytime, Max.
Thank you, Mark Langdon.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Archie Winter.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barry Glendening.
You're very welcome.
We'll be back
on Saturday.
Oh, no. We're doing a quarterfinal preview pod now England are through. Barry, are you free Thursday morning at 9?
I'm off Thursday, actually.
I'm
off Wednesday and Thursday.
Interesting thing is, that was the first audible gasp, wasn't it? It was not because England have won in the Euros. It was that Barry had to do a little bit more work. Anyway, we'll be back on Thursday, perhaps with Barry, perhaps without. Who knows? And we look forward to speaking to you then.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.